Welcome to the Back Porch Education Podcast. Today on the show, Steve and I discuss a very difficult but equally rewarding book by Walker Percy entitled Love in the Ruins.
Jason.
Yes, sir.
I am going to preempt you, and instead of allowing you to tell us one of your Robert Frost-like poems...
I was going T.S. Eliot today, but go ahead.
Well, to cut you off at the pass, I have a quote from the book that we're discussing today.
Okay.
Walker Percy's Love in the Ruins, just yanked out of the middle of it somewhere, comes this quote. Comes again the longing, the desire that has no name. Is it for Mrs. Prouty? For a drink? For both? For a party? For youth? For the good times? For dear, good drinking and fighting comrades? For football game girls in the fall with faces like flowers? Comes the longing, and it has to do with being 15 and 50. And with the winter sun striking down into a brickyard and on clabbered walls rounded off with old hard blistered paint, and across a door sill onto linoleum. Desire has a smell of cold linoleum and gas heat and the sour piebald bark of crepe myrtle. A good-humored 35-year-old lady takes the air in a back lot in a small town.
Well, let's see, chosen.
I think the question you often ask me after one of your poems is, so what do you think?
Right. What do I think? I think that that was way more helpful than the T.S. Eliot poem that I was going to use to get us started.
Well, that's a good thing, because help is what you need with Walker Percy.
That's right. Indeed. We'll see if our listeners maybe can, by the end of this podcast, take a guess at what T.S. Eliot I was going to pull.
Contest on the comments section.
Right.
Winner gets
not
a free
everybody
coffee
at
cup.
Once. That's right. Yeah. Free. Well, hey, you're, spoiler alert. But, okay. Yeah. You need help with Walker Percy. And sometimes you need a second go. Full disclosure, everybody. This is our second try. We talked about this book once together.
For 40 minutes.
Yeah, for a good long time. And we managed not to put it together the way that we wanted
to.
It's
Jason's trying to be careful and euphemistic, and I'm just going to say, it was terrible.
It was rough. It was. So, when you have a rough book, you've got a couple options. One is to just quit.
Yeah.
Leave off entirely. Forget this. We could have done that. And here we are again. This must be worth it.
Yeah, I think this book is worth it. And I don't want people hearing our introduction to throw their hands up in the air and say, well, fine, you've convinced me. I'm not going to approach this book.
Mm-hmm.
Walker Percy has his reputation for a good reason.
Yeah.
He was a fine observer of late 20th century nuttiness.
Yes.
And he could, like any good sort of dystopic writer...
Mm-hmm.
If he took where he saw us at in the 60s, 70s and pushed it, he just did us the favor of imagining a world in which we took our ideas seriously.
That's right.
And so but it is difficult. I think he on purpose fashions a story that makes you work at it.
Right.
He doesn't want you to lull you into an eye candy kind of novel.
No.
He wants you having to think about it. So we, maybe to give a little structure for the folks, we enter a story in the middle of the story.
That's right. Yeah. So here we are in a clover leaf in the sort of interstate, right? And our doctor, Dr. Thomas Moore, is having an allergic episode to the alcohol that he has consumed.
Well, let's
to the albumin in the gin fizzes that he's allergic has consumed.
To the egg whites and gin fizzes.
Right.
Which he refuses to give up.
Right. And, I just now all of a sudden realized, I think that it's exactly that. The gin fizz, like, okay, this is not the way that this should go. I'll save it.
Okay. Because
of reasons. Okay. We'll come back to it. But yeah, here he is. Here's a doctor, and we're going to move around a lot in time through the novel, right? But he is in a sort of end of the world situation.
Yep.
And the stakes are high. He's fearing for his life.
He fears he's being hunted by a sniper.
That's right. And he has the three women of his life to protect, who are like lovers, right? Basically.
And he's sort of gotten them all to rooms in an old Howard
Hotel.
Johnson,
yeah, sort of
that is no longer in operation, and he's kind of squatted there and is set up. I don't want to use the term harem.
No, but it's not that sexual.
No, he's just got a spot.
Yeah.
Where he's protecting those that he's concerned about.
Right.
Let's call it that way.
Right. Yeah, and here they are, and he is a Catholic, and he knows it, and he's a bad Catholic,
right.
And he knows it.
From his own mouth.
That's right.
Yep.
And the world is going bad.
Right.
Let's say at two levels.
At two levels.
Okay, go ahead.
His world is going bad.
Absolutely.
And has been bad for a while.
Absolutely.
Hence the gin fizzes, etc.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he, in talking about his Catholicism, says, "I stopped eating the body of Christ when my child died."
Yeah.
My daughter died. So he's been through personal tragedies, lost his wife, etc. He's trying to figure out who he is in the middle of life.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of a Dantean, you know, wandering in the dark wood,
being
chased about by wild beasts kind of motif.
Yep.
But as you've put it, the world.
Yeah, that's right.
The whole kit and caboodle is going nuts. Interestingly for us, at a high level of division, political division.
Absolutely. Left and right are
caricatures.
Very separate. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. They are, it's in a bad way. The left is a group that is all for all of the things that sort of the uber progressive becomes known for, right? And it's, that's happening. At the same time, on the other side, we have the right who call themselves the knotheads.
Yes.
And they are.
And again, they call themselves.
They call themselves the knotheads. Which is the first inkling for us into one thing that we have not mentioned about this book. And that is, it's hilarious.
Yes.
It is just laugh your head off funny.
Right. It's almost like the whole apocalyptic TV genres with the zombies, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've got kind of your Walking Dead serious.
Right.
You could die at any moment. Danger is around each corner.
Right.
And then there's more like the Zombie Land.
Yes.
Bill Murray, Woody Harrelson world.
Right.
Of... Yes, the
kind
whole
of a
world is being in,
almost.
Yes,
yeah.
It's like the scary movie kind
of
thing.
Right,
and so the scariness of the world at this point in the hands of a man named Thomas More.
Yes.
Whose ancient relative wrote a utopia.
Right.
At this point, the author chooses to write in the ridiculous.
Yes.
It is so pushed to extremes,
right,
as to be stupid.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And our listener, the proposed reader, would find himself almost despite himself laughing,
right,
at just how far,
yeah,
this has been pushed.
That's right.
Even it, keep in mind, I think this is a 1973-ish,
okay,
somewhere,
yeah,
in that early 70s.
I believe you.
And here we are quite a bit further down the road than that.
Right.
It's still silly.
Still.
Right.
Less,
but still.
Yes.
And so I think that that's one of the things that despite the, at moments, confusion, where am I? You're willing to press through.
Right.
Because you got to see how this comes out. There's too many hilarious characters doing too many weird things.
Right.
For you to not, how's this all going to come together?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. I think that would be if I were teaching this book, one of the questions that I would ask is this a comedy or a tragedy?
Yes.
Right.
And that's where this tragicomedy comes into play.
That's right. That's
well, the
right.
The modern writer, and this is my thing, is Percy is modern.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Southern, existential, modern.
Yeah.
I mean, he's very sort of, what's his face? Faulkner,
yep.
Very mm-hmm. Flannery O'Connor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're all of a piece. They're separate. Mm-hmm. You can distinguish them, but it's a this sensibility,
right,
this sort of absolute disaster in cufflinks, right? Like, it is.
But it's interesting, but he's modern, that you bring up those two. So Faulkner is a modern who's in angst.
Right.
Who's saddened.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You read him and you're down. I mean, I'm sorry, but
right,
that's where you're going with
it. Oh,
and
agreed. O'Connor.
O'Connor is sort of the horror. There's more humor in her writing, but it's still pretty ouch.
Yeah.
You finish a story of hers, if you're honest,
yeah,
you've been preached at. So
yeah,
not in a proper way, not in a bad way.
Right.
I love Flannery O'Connor.
Yeah.
Percy has found that touch where he can still laugh at it.
Mm-hmm.
He's much lighter than
mm-hmm.
those other two.
Mm-hmm.
You're right, he's in their camp.
Yeah.
And he is saying, especially down here in the South.
Right, right.
We have demons to reckon with.
Right, right.
But we can still chuckle.
Yeah.
We can still chortle at our sin.
Right. Excellent usage of chortle there.
Yes.
We can guffaw.
Guffaw. I'm not going to go any further with
right.
that. So, rest easy, listener.
Right, right. Yeah, we're fine. We all know synonyms.
Yes.
I shouldn't have done that.
Where's your thesaurus?
So, if I may, hazard a literary reference here in King Lear, as we are watching that tragedy unfold and mm-hmm. everything's going from bad to worser.
Yes.
what we have is the fool who continues to laugh mm-hmm. at Lear. And when you're watching it or when you're reading it, it kind of feels like twisting the knife, that he's twisting mm-hmm. the knife on Lear. But that's his job.
Right.
That's his
exactly.
job.
That's what he gets paid to do.
Exactly. And so what is terrifying is that the fool might stop making fun of Lear.
Mm.
Because if he does that, then that really is Lear's complete destruction.
Yeah,
if even the fool,
the hope is gone.
Right.
Yep.
And so I'm not well, I guess I am sort of drawing a parallel of the laughing fool, right? That Percy is sort of in that Southern sensibility genre, that crew. He is the one who is, despite how bad it's going to get, he's going to laugh.
Yeah. Almost mock.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's interesting that he has Dr. Thomas Moore.
Yep.
Whose doctorate is in psychology.
Yes.
So this is not the fool.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost the foil.
Okay.
Right? Yeah, this is the one whom people are coming to try and figure it out.
Yeah.
And you know, the move I have with almost everything I've read about Percy,
mm-hmm.
and I've read some of his nonfiction and several of his fiction pieces, I'm regularly scratching my head.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm trying to put it together. What's he saying? Why is he hasn't have this happening? There's a you and I have talked off mic about the fact that there's just all this at least potential symbolism running through the thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But certainly his choice of making Dr. Moore a psychologist,
right,
a scientist of the human psyche,
yep,
and that he's pushed the medical model of psychology to a mechanistic model,
right,
where he has invented this thing,
yeah, science fiction to a science fiction level,
yeah,
right.
He's invented a device that allows you to change men's minds.
Right. Literally. On a physical level. Yes.
Not with the application of various chemicals.
No.
But with the application of an electronic device.
Right.
The
lapsometer.
The lapsometer, which originally was designed to just read where a brain is at.
Right.
Various brain waves to various regions of the body.
Right.
You get readings and you understand what's going on and why they're acting the way they're acting.
Mm-hmm.
But then he, of course, couldn't resist, if I can read it.
What if I could change
it? What if I could zap it?
Yeah.
Interestingly, in the Frankensteinian sense.
Yeah.
You know, with electricity.
Yeah, that's right.
If it is alive, we will zap it.
So, yeah, no, that's good. I think that's crucial to where he's trying to go. This is one of the questions that the novel is interested in. Will the medical model of repairing man, the sin nature of man, will it work? Spoiler alert, no.
Yeah.
It will not work.
Well, he turns it on its head and says that the sin nature of man will take his invention
right
and use it to control people.
Exactly.
Why a psychologist wouldn't have thought of that? Right. It's kind of, but he almost immediately realizes
mm-hmm.
as this thing goes out there and he's offered, you know, if you'll let us have the rights to it, I see a Nobel Prize in this for you, man.
Uh-huh.
And you know, so they make a plea to his vanity,
mm-hmm.
and he's almost taken in, but he's still recognizing they want to mass produce this and control vast amounts of the population with this.
Right.
This is not good. But it's interesting that alongside him are colleagues who, so if you can control the mind, certainly issues like violence, self-destruction,
right,
deception, etc., right, are in there. But I the title then comes into play.
Okay.
Love.
Yeah.
In the ruins.
Right.
And now you have at a scientific level,
mm-hmm.
the notion that love is to be studied scientifically, and so you have this little window into a whole kind of little sex clinic,
yeah,
where they've got machinery hooked up and they're clinical about their Freudian notions.
Yeah, that's right. Like clinical, certainly it's uber Freudian. Like
yes.
it is
that group has
Huxley. Molded,
yeah.
Right.
Everything comes down to
right.
The religion.
Right.
Is the sex. And yet in his own life, as we've already attributed.
Right.
He has these interests. You were quick to latch on. It's not Freudian. It's not overtly sexual.
Right.
It's the human heart needs love.
Yes.
I've lost my daughter and I've lost my wife, the two loves of my life, and there's this hole.
Right.
And I'm a bad Catholic.
Right.
Jesus isn't filling that hole.
Right.
What will?
Yep.
And so he has these three different ladies, quite different.
Right.
Who all represent, in my mind at least, different forms of love or different... different angles of
love. Right, that's a good way to say it. Yeah, because it's
and he's not sure which one he wants. He wants all of them.
Well, that's exactly right. Exactly. Well, and I think this is a stab at the modern notion that things can that our wants can be divided. Hmm. Well, that we can piecemeal things, that we can separate everything and get. That it's buffet style.
Yeah, I like that, buffet. Yeah. And he has a buffet of women.
That really is what it is. Like,
I mean, and he's quick to articulate the aspects of each of these women that are attractive to him.
Right.
What he's hoping for in these relationships. He's not, it's not that he's found three women that are kind of alike and I got to distinguish which one to work with. They're three fairly radically different in age, in appearance, in how he met them, and how he's been involved with them.
Well, the role that they fill in his life,
yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. Like you said, the kind of love that they offer,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
I mean, the book it's not sort of crude.
Right, no,
it's not some sort of it's not that sort of book. I mean, there is a younger, attractive girl whom he is interested in, but it's not anything like
it's not gratuitous,
smutty, right?
Yeah,
Percy is attempting to work out. This notion, in addition to some of the things that the lapsometer measures, you mentioned a few, two that are really, really important I think because they are perversions of love in a certain sense in the novel, is what the left... and the right struggle with. The left struggle with anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And the right, or I'm sorry, the knotheads, the conservatives, struggle with rage.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is when Moore finally gets his lapsometer and he starts measuring people,
mm-hmm.
what he realizes is that left-leaning people are struggling with anxiety. Right-leaning knotheads are struggling with rage. And if I can just tweak them physically in their brain, then how soon will the world be perfect?
Right. Not very soon.
Not soon.
it's another quote, if I can.
Sure.
With his lapsometer.
Yeah.
It says... he registered a dizzy 7.6 mmv over Brodmann 32, the area of abstractive activity.
Oh, boy.
Since that time, I have learned that a reading over 6 generally means that a person has so abstracted himself from himself and from the world around him, seeing things as theories and himself as a shadow, that he cannot, so to speak, re-enter the lovely, ordinary world.
Mm.
Such a person, and there are millions, is destined to haunt the human condition like the Flying Dutchman.
Okay. I have been trying not to do it, but it's time. Percy is very Kierkegaardian.
Here we go. Soren! Good to see you.
That's right.
For our listeners, Jason may have sort of an intellectual crush on Soren Kierkegaard.
I do, and I'm unashamed.
He may, I say.
That's right, that's right.
Jury's still out.
So, Percy was going, I think either in medical school or had become an MD. A great many of the details I'm very hazy on. But at one point he contracts tuberculosis,
right?
And he reads deeply when he's on bed rest for months and months. And the things that he reads are primarily Kierkegaard and Dostoevsky, mm-hmm. Right? And so
that'll cheer you up every time.
Right. It's like, I have tuberculosis. Guess I'll read some Kierkegaard. Yeah.
Throw a little Nicholas Sparks in there and you're good. Sorry, Nick, I'm not picking on you. Right. You're our neighbor down here in North Carolina.
That's right. So he's in that situation. And that's what he chooses to read. And so he's very interested. I mean, when I read, I don't think I'm far off here. The Moviegoer, his first novel, mm-hmm. It starts with an epigraph from Kierkegaard, for crying out loud. Yeah, so I'm not off base. Yeah, I mean, it's
Percy
there.
Is a disciple of Kierkegaard.
Totally. And he is, so he's very interested in despair. Mm-hmm. And where it shows up and where it doesn't show up. And what he's realizing, and I think showing us in this novel, is that it doesn't show up where you expect it to show up, which is when somebody's down in the dumps, right? Instead, where despair shows up is when everything is just humdrum, when everything is routine, mm-hmm. normal, everyday, suburban, white picket fence sort of life. Amusing ourselves to death, sort of to borrow from Neil Postman's, I think, excellent work. I'll point to a specific example because that's what I tell my students you should do when you are building a case.
Yeah, don't have these general abstractions.
That's right. That's right. there is a patient, I think, pretty early on in the novel, who is in a situation where he has found himself no longer able to make love to his wife. Mm-hmm. Okay, a young guy, healthy guy, everything looks totally fine. You know, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to make love to your wife, and yet you're not able to, patient. And so this patient has actually come in asking for a medical answer to this problem, right? And so what Thomas More, the psychologist, does is he says to his patient, my prescription is for you to walk home through the swamp. Hmm. Rather than getting in your car and driving the 12 miles or whatever, walk through the swamp, walk the 6 or 8 miles home. That's the prescription. And the guy says, what? Seriously, you can't be serious. And he is serious. He says, well, give it a try. I mean, you're coming to me for this. Seriously, give it a shot. Yeah. And so the patient gets home, like after his wife has already called the cops. It's like 3 in the morning, right? Yeah. He's half dead, eaten up with mosquitoes, you know, and then is able to make love to his wife. He has been shaken out of the malaise.
Yep.
Right?
Slapped across the face.
Exactly. And so I told you that I would save the gin fizz comment, but this is where it's at, mm-hmm. right? Gin fizz is my other point for this. Thomas More is, I think, self-medicating, whether he realizes it or not.
Sure.
He is continuing to take in those egg yolks that are not good for him, that he's having an allergic reaction to. But in so doing, it's knocking the dust off.
Yep.
Right? It's shaking him out of that despair, because hardship is like a splash of cold water. It wakes you up.
He's holding his hand in the fire.
Right. It's real life all of a sudden.
Yeah, that quote about the abstracted people can't re-enter the beautiful real world. Right. They've become numb to reality.
Yeah.
Right. And it's a worthy point that so much of this book is about various ways people are trying to escape. He has this whole golf course motif.
Yeah.
What's your favorite quote there from the banner?
Oh, dude, hysterical! It is Jesus Christ, the greatest pro of them all.
And they have these massive mega purse golf championships,
right,
with fully lit courses. They play at night.
Right.
It's Percy's love of golf, but working itself out. You know, it's a traditional golfer imagining for himself the worst possible extremes that money could do to damage
this beautiful
game.
That's well said. How could money ruin this game?
Yeah.
And he does it.
And he does it. Right. Yeah. It's become almost a religion.
Yeah.
And is a major financial aspect to this city on the edge of the world, so to speak.
That is, and it's well connected to the church.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So religion and politics are, in Love in the Ruins, very connected.
Yeah.
Right. There's literally the Catholic Church has split, right? Everyone else, the Protestants, have lost their minds entirely, and the Catholic Church has split, and you have the what basically becomes a sort of wealth, sort of prosperity gospel. The American Catholic Church basically becomes prosperity gospel, and they have
country club.
Yeah, it's country club religion. Yeah, literally. Not to put too fine a point on it, but he does. They have Property Rights Sunday.
Yep.
Right? Where they come and just celebrate and thank God for property rights. Mm. I mean, I guess thank God for property rights, but it's elevated not to the obscene, but to the absurd.
Yep, correct. Well said. And I think it's this. I think one of the biggest problems Percy has with the modern mind is its deduction that all is absurd.
Right.
Fine. I'll show you what absurdity looks like.
Right.
One of the difficulties of the book is, of course, I'm not certain that it gives any answers.
Yeah.
It's. Somewhat like a mediocre psychologist.
Yeah.
It helps you identify a lot of the problems.
Sure.
Helps you talk through all the moans that you have in the night. But then when it comes to, I don't know that the advice is much better than you know, walk home through the swamp.
Yeah.
Keep going. But, I mean, it does come to an end, not in despair. There is hope there.
Yeah.
But it's not a formulaic one. It's not do A, B, and C, and all is going to be well.
That's right, and it's not episodic either. So the, I think a lot of current laments are laments that are really just complaining about the way things are, and hearkening back to the golden time when everything was better.
Yeah,
he does not do that.
No.
There is no age that was better.
Right.
There is no...
Well, so do you remember who he blames for all the problems of the world?
Thomas More?
No,
or Percy?
Oh, so in the book,
yeah,
a philosopher is blamed for this division of the heart.
Oh, gosh, man, I should know this.
Let me give you the quote.
Okay.
It's all a setup for me to read another one of my quotes. My lapse meter, the first caliper of the soul.
Genius.
And the first hope of bridging the dread chasm that has rent the soul of Western man ever since the famous philosopher Descartes.
Yes.
There he is.
There he is.
Ripped body loose from mind and turned the very soul into a ghost that haunts its own house.
Ooh.
Percy could turn a phrase.
Yes, he could.
Rips the body loose from mind and turns the soul into a ghost that haunts its own house. And I'm willing to say that that's well played. I see that far too much.
Yeah.
That everything called important in our day is, it's almost like instead of looking right on at what it means to be human, we have a crazy eye that's 30 degrees off.
Mm.
And it's so focused on the unimportant things that all the important things are gone. And the notion of a soul haunting its own house is very poignant to me. And what I think makes this book worthwhile, it's not the answer. It's the scope into the soul.
Right.
We don't have lapsometers, but we have Percy.
Right.
To give us a little bit of a reading on the screwiness of our modern culture. And I think that's helpful, even if you already know that things are screwy.
Right.
It's helpful for someone to come along and help you, to embody an idea.
Right.
To move it from the abstract to even fictional flesh and blood.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you, by the end of the story, I think most people will start out kind of pitying more.
Yeah.
And by the end of the story are rooting for him.
That's right. That I was.
Yeah.
I mean, that was my trajectory.
You find yourself almost in spite of yourself identifying.
Yeah.
Okay. I've been in this room.
That's right. That's right.
I've heard these talks.
I mean, it is deeply human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are, and that was our problem when we tried to talk the first time. And I guess for our listeners, if you think this is bad, but I think maybe that was our problem the first time, is that we were trying to pin down how the book was so utterly absurd and yet also so authentically human simultaneously. I don't think that we want to affirm, and I don't think that Percy affirms, that human life is absurdity. I mean, I'm not...
Right, right.
I'm not headed there.
So he's got a two-part novel. I haven't read the first part. I only read the sequel, which I guess
okay.
But he wrote The Last Gentleman,
mm-hmm.
and then followed it up with The Second Coming. And I've read The Second Coming.
Gotcha.
And the main character there, again, with a medical background,
right,
falls in love with a girl who has escaped from a mental institution.
Okay.
And the whole novel is about who's really crazy here.
Hmm.
The sane
doctor
with all of his accoutrement.
Mm-hmm.
Or this girl who seems, for him, incredibly grounded and sees the world a lot more clearly than most of his friends do.
Which, that's so Dostoevsky.
Yeah.
That is so, I'm right to the brothers there.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, just the notion that it's the, Well, we don't have to talk about all of Dostoevsky.
We can have a whole episode on Dostoevsky if you'd like. But,
but that one's going to be long because Russian novels, everybody, strap in. It's a long one.
Yeah. No, but I think that to a couple of things come to my mind to kind of bring it to an end here.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, as a podcast on education, teachers, if they have control over their reading list in a history or humanities setting, will often tend to choose books that they feel are teachable.
Yeah.
And you read this book, you're going to say, I would never try and teach this if you're about comfort.
Right? That's right.
I think it would be a fascinating book to teach through in the right setting, in a group of medium level readers, but the point here to me is that even difficult books are worth reading.
Yeah,
right.
Good.
I have a lot of students who shy away from some of the books in our reading list. Dante's Inferno is a good example. I get lost. I don't know what's going on, Mr. Elliott.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Faerie Queen that offers this extensive allegory.
Right.
And they get the story. They just don't know what he means by it. What is it? Because they don't. And I find that there's a great deal of benefit in having to work through something instead of just have it all given to you.
Right.
Right.
Well, that's Love in the Ruins.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Like walk through the swamp.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's real life.
Yeah. Right? Real life isn't easy.
Right.
And so the novel that makes it less easy is probably more real.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is that. And I do hope our listeners, especially those who haven't read the book, those who have are probably all, why didn't they cover this and why didn't they say this and so
right.
on and so on. But that's just criticism, right? We face that every time we read a book.
Right.
But for those who haven't, please do engage with it.
Yeah,
and recognize that what we've prepared you for is a carnival ride.
It is.
It's not a quick, surefire, feel good.
No,
I don't think anybody's ever going to try and turn this into a movie.
No, it would have to be like Terrence Malick.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Like, you just have to go in knowing I'm going to get lost. In
right.
This.
It, yes. Like it would take a certain kind of director.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it is. It's not something for the screen. It's so penetrating and introspective.
It's inward. Yeah. It's inward. Yeah.
Right. It's in his head, man. Mm-hmm. The movie would be. Dude walks across room.
Well, it's the reaction I had the first time I watched Ferris Bueller.
Okay.
Is this would be so much better as a book? Right? If you knew what was going through the head of Ferris Bueller on that day.
Right.
Right? And how he is internally enjoying this maybe the last day off I ever get.
Sure.
As amusing and fun as the outward action and story might be.
Right.
Wouldn't you love to be in his head?
Yeah.
And that's with him breaking the fourth wall.
Right, right.
Right? And talking to the camera and telling us.
Right.
He doesn't tell us enough.
No.
We don't know. Yeah. We know just enough to love him.
Yeah, to keep us in.
But,
right.
but we're not really enjoying the day like he did.
Yeah.
And we're really not feeling the horror of the odometer problem, etc. And what am I going to do with this girlfriend a year from
right,
now and
all that right.
kind of stuff. So Percy actually is able to take us inside the mind of somebody who knows too much about what's going on in other people's minds.
Right.
And is trying to make sense of it for himself and for the world.
Yeah.
And it's a great read.
It is. And I think that it shows... it has a good way of, like you mentioned earlier, it doesn't give solutions, but it asks questions that deserve answers, right? And so, we don't have lapsometers. Fine. what does it say about us as a society that we think a lapsometer would help? Right.
Yeah. Well, you brought up Huxley earlier.
Yeah.
Right. So there's the soma.
Lots of resonance there.
Right. So Huxley understood that the medical model was going to lead towards
pleasure. Right.
Yes, pleasure as the ultimate desire, but the prescription would be a pill, right? That the yeah. soma would be
right.
taken, that it would be a chemical solution.
Mm-hmm.
Percy's making an electronic
yeah.
solution,
yeah.
but they're both saying science can fix this.
Right, brain in a vat.
Man's smarts.
Well, we're back to Descartes. The soul has been ripped out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's just the bag of bones.
Mm-hmm.
And so twist this, turn this up, turn this down, and boom.
Yeah, but Moore says love is the thing. The question is what kind of love?
Right.
And you know, as a Christian, I come into the novel at the end and say, if you take all those forms of love.
Yeah.
And then make it eternal and infinite,
mm-hmm.
then you have a real solution.
Right.
You have a logos. You have an answer I can accept.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in God.
Yeah.
Not in a girl.
That's right.
Locked up
right.
in a hotel room somewhere.
That's not going to come.
Or a thing.
Yeah.
stuck on my head.
Right.
zapping my brain. As,
that's right.
As odd as that whole thing is.
Yeah.
It's a good conversation, man.
Yep. I enjoyed it.
You can't have your meat if you don't eat your vegetables.